Lifestyle matters. It's more than money.
I'm Faisal Carmelli, my co-host here, Dave Popowich. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm great, Faisal. How are you doing?
Ooh, I'm riled up.
Well, we both get ready. A bit spicy, hey?
It's going to be a spicy show today.
I think it might be because we're going to talk a little bit about could economic policies out of the United States create a war with China?
Ooh, I smell bully.
Hmm?
Now, who the bully is, we'll have to find out.
I have to find out. What about housing prices? This has been on everybody's mind. Is this a budget issue? What are we going to do? Does business have a role to play in this? I don't know. We better explore that because it's literally on everybody's mind.
And what money managers can do to ruin your retirement.
Mm.
That's an interesting one.
Yep.
People look at money managers as the solution
that's right.
To your retirement.
Are they the guys you go to?
Yeah.
Fun topic to explore. You bet. So
we've got a great show. I think there's going to be a very interesting topic, a bunch of topics. But what was interesting this week was the reaction to the economic numbers that came out, as well as the expectation of interest rates.
Yeah. And so let's talk about, we finished the first quarter of the year pretty good, right? Markets did pretty well. And then we come into April, and really the first 4 days, trading days in April, were pretty dismal, right? But the economic data is improving. What's going on there?
Yeah. It's interesting. And I think the problem that we're facing right now is the markets in general, both stock and bond markets, have been looking forward to rate cuts. Hmm. And they think if we have lower interest rates, it's better. And so they've positioned them, the markets, both bond and stock markets, in that way. And as the data comes out, it's still looking pretty good.
But what if interest rates are higher in the market and the economy's clicking along and doing just fine?
This is my biggest beef with the way that we have spent, we mean the media in general, have spent way too much time focused on rate cuts, than what's the real economic issues.
Right. Well, the market, if you put them as a person, they're OCD, right? The markets are OCD all the time. And they just happen to be OCD right now on interest rate cuts, right?
I didn't think you're going to say that. Yeah, but I think, yes. I think there's when you look at what, break it down step by step, what's really happening here. If the economy is doing well, employment is doing well, both countries, Canada, U.S., inflation is slowly working its way down to a target rate. It may not be at the speed that we want it to be back down to. Is the world that bad of a place then? Let's pick U.S. and Canada primarily. Mm-hmm. Are those two countries bad because interest rates are, I don't know, normal range?
Yeah, so it's a good question. Like just talk about jobs data that we saw on Friday as an example of this, okay?
Yeah.
So the United States created more jobs than what was expected by a considerable amount. Their unemployment rate ticked down. It was as expected. But the inflation rate was as expected, as wage inflation also came down. So you got an environment where, you know, everybody's employed. They're making money. They're making more money than they were last year. They're spending money in the economy. It's being reflected in GDP. And as you said, we've got this slow but steady tick down in inflation. How much of the problem do you think is patience? We want things to happen immediately.
Oh, 100%.
Right.
100% it's patience.
Right.
That's the problem. And I think when we look back, when you and I were chatting on this show, let's go late last year, I was in the camp that we're going to probably see 4 to 6 interest rate cuts.
Well, that was
between 2 and 2.5% off of where we're at.
Yep.
Based the way that the data was showing. And then we're starting to see maybe it's not 4 to 6, maybe it's 3 to 4.
Right.
Now it's maybe 2 to 3. Some are even saying if we get one, we'd be lucky.
Yeah, and some are kicking around the idea of none, right?
And let's just go with none. Is that so bad? Is that really going to ruin things? And I think we've been...
Well, let me add some to that. What if there's none and the economy is growing?
It is. There hasn't been any rate cuts.
Right. Is that bad? It's a good question.
Is it restrictive? Yes. It's supposed to be restrictive. Is it containing inflation and reducing it to a target level? It's on its way. It could uptick for sure. Commodity prices up and so on and so forth.
Yep.
But the reaction of, oh my God, the interest rates haven't gone down. The markets are going to fall. You know, things are not affordable as they were. Inflation is still high. Inflation is still high.
Yep.
And inflation is not based on the 2.8% that was noted in the last number. It's people remembering what the price of a certain good was last year, 2 years ago.
Pre-pandemic, yeah, exactly.
And it's the impact.
Yeah.
And people People's memories are based upon the reaction or the experience after the event happens.
Right.
And after the event of high inflation and the price hasn't gone down, we need deflation to calm everybody down, mm-hmm. not lower inflation.
Right. Yeah, you have to actually have prices back up. Right. That's the difference, right? Right.
And the headline piece, gasoline, whatever the reason is, taxes and so forth, look how much it is at the pump. Look at how much my groceries are. Yep, yeah, that's all gone up. Mm-hmm. And it's gone up substantially. Mm-hmm. And until we start seeing it go back down.
And how will it go back down?
You need a big problem. Like, let's think about what has to right. happen in order for the price of oil to fall, gasoline prices to fall, food prices to fall. You need a massive recession.
You need no demand for those things, right? You need no, how do you get no demand? When people lose their jobs and they're not working and they're not driving their vehicles around and.
And so we have to be careful what we ask for.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And so the reaction of of where the pain point is based on what was the experience prior to the pain. Yeah. It was better. The prices were better
yeah.
2-3 years ago than they are today. This is ridiculous. And I understand that. Now let's take the opposite view of that. The stock market. Mm-hmm. People have forgotten what 2008 did.
Yes.
In this province alone, what 2014-15 went like.
Yep.
Because they're not investing as if those things can happen again.
Right. Now, no, you're exactly right. So you got this historical reference point. Friday morning was an interesting example. You know, I used the term with you, you know, we had cats and dogs playing together,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because you had this jobs data come out and it showed mixed, okay, a stronger than expected labor market, okay, wage inflation likely moving down. And we saw bond yields moving, certainly in the United States, yields were moving higher and you had stock markets moving higher in the early trade, right? That's it. Cats and dogs are playing together and getting along.
Yeah, this when you mentioned that to me, the thought that was going through my head is when my middle daughter was around 5 years of age, she'd be ripping up, running up and down the hallway. She'd bang into something, generally a wall. You'd hear the big thunk, and you're like, "Are you okay?" And she'll be like, "I'm okay," and she keeps on running. And it's like we get this kind of data point and bam, oh, I'm okay. And we keep on going. And then get into another, we hit another good wall. Analogy. Bam. Sorry?
That's a good analogy.
It's a good analogy. You like that one?
Yeah.
It's the first thought that came in my head. Just, poor Jenna. I'm okay. I can still hear her saying that out loud. And that's what the markets are saying. Bam, we've got this data. We got more jobs than we expected. Boom. But I'm okay.
Right.
We're okay.
Right.
But that doesn't mean the markets are going to be okay because they're expecting something different.
Yeah, yeah. And you got to remember that it is emotional. Like sometimes we forget about the fact that markets collectively, this thing we call the market, can be an emotionally driven machine like a person on any given day, right? And so how much can you actually infer from any given day's trading?
Here's a little forecasting that I've been looking at.
Okay.
When you start seeing commodity prices take off, mm-hmm. it's not always a good sign. It's great for Alberta, for example, right. the oil side.
Right.
Not so good for the rest of the world.
Right.
So we know, being in Alberta, if the price of oil is doing well, the rest of the world is paying for it.
Mm-hmm. That's a tax on most of the world, right?
Which is a slowdown.
Right.
So be prepared as we start seeing $90 oil, potentially $95 oil.
Yeah.
That's a tax on growth. For a lot of people and a lot of companies,
yeah.
that could be the slowdown that we're looking for.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you make a terrific point. Let's sort of wrap this up a little bit. But I think we have to be, you know, we're in a market environment where good news can be bad news. And sometimes bad news can be good news, given whatever the market tends to be focused on right now. Let's just say inflation and interest rate cuts, right? The focus on cuts. But you always have to look at the underlying data. And our companies, ultimately, if you're investing in a company, you want it to be making more money, right? Doing a better job, servicing more customers. Keep your eye on the ball on those things, and you got to make sure you're not trapped too much in the noise.
That's right.
Faisal, let's talk a little bit about the headlines for a second here, because geopolitical tensions are rising, and it's on a lot of people's minds right now. We got to sort of try to dissect how this actually influences you know, geopolitics and economics and how they work together.
And what crossed our desk is a book that we've seen called A World Safe for Commerce. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason why we're bringing this guest on here is not only is he a professor out of the University of Virginia. Not only is the author of this book, but okay, we can't say this too loud for our American friends. He has some Canadian ties.
That's right.
He's got some Canadian ties. So we not only do we get a U.S. economic and political viewpoint, but we also get it from a Canadian perspective of a person living in the United States now.
We've never had a guy from Virginia know where Calgary is. Dale, welcome to the show. Dale Copeland, professor of international relations at the University of Virginia.
It is really good to be here. And just full disclosure, I grew up in Victoria, British Columbia. So, but I have a good friend in Alberta, Calgary, Alberta. And my mom and dad were both born there. So there's connections there. We don't have to go across the Rockies and have that divide.
Well, welcome and thanks for joining us. Let's get right to this because we've got a 10-minute segment to do a very complicated topic. And Dale, I want to jump right into getting your feedback on essentially how you see economics in general influencing the current geopolitical landscape.
Straightforwardly, let's focus on the big issue, which is U.S.-China. We don't have a lot of trade, as you know, with Russia, and that's a separate issue. But U.S. and China are trading more than ever, over $700 billion this year. And there's been a lot of talk about decoupling or reducing that trade. And it's really up to the U.S. to decide because China wants the trade. It needs the trade to grow and to help support its economic reforms at home. And it's got some structural problems, as everyone knows, debt and infrastructure problems. So China wants to trade. It's up to the U.S. to decide whether to keep trading with China. And my argument is a very straightforward one, and it's based on history and theory, namely that if another state like China has positive expectations about the future trade environment, thinks it's going to keep getting the trade, the resources, the markets, it will be quite moderate and want to be moderate so that it can keep the trade going. On the other hand, and as we learned from 1941 Japan, if those expectations of trade, future trade, turn sour, then all bets are off. That state would start to feel like it's being constrained or pushed into the ground. If it starts to decline, like Japan did severely in 1941, it may do some of the worst things that you can imagine, like attack the whole system. So my view is a very conditional one, but it's a very optimistic one. If the U.S. is smart enough to maintain positive expectations in China for future trade through its own trade policies, then peace in East Asia can be maintained and, in fact, supported and develop.
And that's a key point that you made, Dale, when you talk about if they want to maintain the trade with the United States. When you look at the economic influence of the United States, for sure, the number one economic superpower in the world. There are other regions that are growing in their view. If you look at EU as a full, you look at India, other parts of Asia, the population growing outside of the United States more than inside of the United States, so the use and so forth. And from a Canadian perspective, on some Canadian media viewpoints, they point out the U.S. being the bully. Do you think U.S. is being the economic or commerce bully that is being portrayed by some media outlets here in Canada?
Well, my view is a realist one, which means we focus on power politics and how both sides have an incentive to increase their position economically and in military terms, territorial terms, throughout history and currently to today. So I would put the blame, if there is to be blame, on both sides. China has had a rather restrictive trade policy, and it's manipulated its currency. It's stolen U.S. intellectual property and helped grow its economy through some of these practices. On the other hand, the U.S., especially under Trump, President Trump, imposed severe trade tariffs on China. It talked about a trade war it had to have with China. Now, Biden has largely backed away from most of that rhetoric. He's kept some of the restrictions on, but mostly on just very high-tech products like the under 15 or 10 nanometer chips, the ones that are made in Taiwan and East Asia. So those restrictions are still on. In fact, they're increased under Biden. But I wouldn't call this an economic containment or sabotage strategy by the U.S. If anything, in the last 6 months, there's been a thawing of relationships. She has basically told Biden directly that he will not and has no intention to invade Taiwan as long as Taiwan does not declare independence. That's a key condition for him. And Biden has said, we won't let Taiwan declare independence so that we can keep this relationship going. And indeed, you, Mr. Xi, but also Beijing, China, can obtain what you need, raw materials, oil, freely, as long as you abide by one condition. You don't attack Taiwan and you don't mess around in East Asia. So this is kind of a conditional logic that can work. It can work based around the power of trade in the modern environment. I'll say one last thing. China has had 40% of its GDP locked up in trade for the last decade. And that's the highest level since Britain in 1905. And as you know, a lot of British trade was with Canada, Australia, and the colonies, so to speak. So this is really a leveraging point for the U.S. And Biden is playing it well. He's playing it well in a moderate sense.
Dale, you mentioned Biden. You mentioned that the fact there's that also the Trump policies. We are now heading into a U.S. election fairly soon. From your perspective, who's best at the role for commerce, for the United States economically? Is it Trump or is it Biden?
I think that's kind of an obvious question, and I think you're trying to lure me down a certain path. I would simply have to say that Trump talks a mean game all the time. He talks about withdrawing from NATO, withdrawing from the East Asia. He's even talked about abandoning Taiwan, which upsets some Republicans. I don't think he would do it in the end. I think it's part of what he did in the early years, 2017, of his own administration, where he puts out these things, uses the rhetoric to, if you will, bully his own allies into spending more on their own defense so that the U.S. doesn't have to. And that includes Canada. And it's straightforwardly, he never really pulled any of those triggers. And I don't think he would. That doesn't mean to say that he won't return to his own Trump tariff policies. But it is worth remembering that he signed agreements with China in the last year to release or relax most of those tariff restrictions. And that regained or rebuilt a fairly healthy trade growth. And now it's over $700 billion. Under Trump, it was about $600 billion. So he did not do what many feared, which is economic disengagement from China.
We have under 1 minute left to go, Dale. When you look at, besides China, who's the next nation or region that the U.S. needs to be aware of, concerned of, and create better relationships with?
Well, Russia is the obvious one in Europe and Eastern Europe, depending upon how you view that. I don't see any immediate resolution of that. Putin is determined, I think for partly glory reasons and not just insecurity reasons, to hold on to his war in Ukraine and perhaps even try to get more territory. I believe strongly that the Canadians and the Americans and the Europeans have to resist that and make sure he doesn't get away with taking over more of Ukraine. But you also have to look, I suppose, at the Middle East. But here, what's interesting is that most of the problems are indirectly caused by terrorist activity that I think Iran is supporting. And I think overall, the U.S. has contained Iran and China is helping. This is the irony, is that China is helping Iran, helping the U.S. to keep Iran relatively moderate. That's a relative phrase, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we're going to have to leave it there. And I want to thank you for breaking down a complex topic into 10 minutes or so. It's been fantastic having you on the show.
Fantastic. Have me back anytime. I love to talk, as you can see.
Dale Copeland, professor of international relations at the University of Virginia, and also the author of A World Safe for Commerce. We've got a budget coming up here relatively soon. What do you think's on people's minds?
Yeah, well, what's on their minds or what people are saying that should be on their minds?
Good question.
So I think housing is definitely on people's minds. Inflation is on people's mind. In the budget, I would not be surprised. They've already been teasing something to do with housing. And it's coming up more and more. And this is one survey that we saw that crossed over, I would say, into the business world. Yeah. When normally we think of housing, we think of it as just an individual family issue, not a business issue. Yeah. So let's see how the crossover happens. And that's why we have our guest today.
Yeah, we've got Michael Capus, a partner with KPMG Canada, joining us today. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Now, KPMG just conducted a survey in advance of the budget. This is the one Faisal was referring to, caught our interest. Maybe you can give us some of the highlights.
Sure, absolutely. Obviously, the housing crisis is without a shadow of a doubt impacting everyone. These days, one study found that just 45% of Canadians can afford a condo, which is down from 60% in 2019, while only 26% can afford a single family home. But we wanted at KPMG to drill down and ask business owners how they were being impacted. So we surveyed over 500 business owners or leaders of small and medium-sized companies across Canada ahead of the federal budget. And really, the ripple effects from the high cost of housing and the lack of supply are indeed being felt right through the economy. So there were three key things that came out from that survey. The first was that 94% of those business owners, the overwhelming majority, said that those high housing costs and the lack of supply are really one of the biggest risks facing Canada's economy. And they really should be top priority in the upcoming federal budget.
So, Michael, can I just jump in there right now with that piece? You said it's 94% of business owners, small, medium-sized enterprises are looking at this, and they're saying it's the top priority for the upcoming budget, according to the business owners. Why do these business owners care about that?
Why do they care? Well, you know, a lot of it has to do with the affordability of wages and of staff to actually even just staff their businesses. If people can't afford to live in a place, then they're likely unlikely to be able to work in that same place. And business owners are really grappling with a really tight labor market and a lot of shortage in supply and affordable staffing, particularly in urban areas where they've witnessed high costs in housing, where housing's scarce and therefore workers are also scarce. And so that creates more pressure on their bottom line. It creates more pressure on the ability for labor to actually move to a particular place across Canada as well. It's an issue for even retaining talent. There's a really big sort of challenge there. 87% sort of agreed that is actually forcing them to pay more and to attract and retain their talent. So it really is having an impact on their overall bottom line.
So then let's go to solutions then. So if business owners, have identified this as a major issue, what did the survey say about the potential solutions to this problem?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the solutions are complicated. There's nothing really straightforward here. Some of what the survey found was business owners were looking for more innovative tax measures and different thinking. So, for example, making mortgage interest payments tax deductible. It's not surprising that 86% of business owners support using the income tax system to actually make housing more affordable. But it's not just about making housing more affordable, because that doesn't actually help solve the supply issue. One estimate sort of talks about Canada needing between 5.8 and 10 million new homes in the next 10 years. And last year alone, we only built 250,000. So we're a far cry from actually being able to meet those targets.
So Michael, let me just jump in there on that piece as well, because that's a good point that you're making. It's not a demand issue. If you change the tax incentives for individuals to make it more affordable, you're increasing the demand.
Right.
So you're not helping the situation. You're not solving the problem, the supply side of the equation. So you've nailed that. Here's what I've learned about other companies around the world, that if they want to hire people, And I'll pick on your company. Your company has done this for many employees around the world. They've provided housing. They've provided some incentive programs for housing. Should it be on the backs of business owners to provide a housing program for their employees, i.e. building housing, creating that opportunity, that space? Are the business owners who are in this survey also going to say, yeah, we're prepared to step up and be part of the solution? Or are they just saying it's a government problem, let them deal with it?
I think it's really an opportunity to bring all levels together. So it's not just the business owners that are on the line for this, but there's actually nonprofit associations, there's different levels of government, and then there's the development community that can actually work around partnership. And I liken it to things that are happening in the childcare sector. So in the childcare sector, you're seeing more private businesses sort of step up and say, I'd like to work with nonprofit childcare centers to try and offer, because I know it's going to have a long-term retention upside for me and my employees. It's probably a similar thing on the housing front side. How can employers sort of work with other associations, other developments to provide that partnership together? Because it's not a simple problem just building more homes, right? Building homes, if it was a simple problem, we would have solved it 5-10 years ago, but it's not. And so there really needs to be a different delivery or partnership model between business, community, and government kind of working together. You know, if a community is attracting commercial business, how are employees getting there? Are they commuting in from long distances or living nearby? Businesses have to think about that. You know, the move to virtual versus in-person, that also dictates sort of, you know, where people can afford to live and where they choose to live as well. What kind of housing is needed as well? Like, we're seeing more trends toward multi-generational housing, and a lot of the apartments and condos that are being built today are for single people or small families, which is not sort of the type of demand that's existing. So it's really about finding that right sort of supply and demand mix there. And I think, you know, businesses have a part to play in it.
Michael, when you look around the world, which countries have got it right? Because I look at our friends down south, they're saying they've got the same problem when it comes to housing and so forth. When you look at parts of Western Europe, you're hearing the same problems that we're expressing. What countries have got it right that we can look at and say, let's follow that model, because it's clearly not working here in Canada the way it is right now?
I mean, interestingly enough, Europe has a really good model because they don't actually have a lot of single family zoning restrictions. So they actually use more apartments. People live in apartments. They live in condominium buildings. They live in more density of housing. We don't have that same sort of thing here happening in Canada. And we have provincials, governments, and federal government that are making different decisions in different places based on the needs of people. So recently you have BC that sort of created this overlay across the province to enable multi-unit development anywhere in the province, right? Other provinces don't believe that that meets the needs of their individuals and of their residents. So it is quite complicated because we are so diverse across the country here. But I would say Europe sort of is an area where people can look to see kind of what works for them.
Let's wrap up this segment if we can, Michael, with just a comment on this. So, you know, after having done the survey and looking at the takeaways, what's the one or two things that you would advise policymakers on and businesses to be thinking about to solve this problem?
Yeah, I think bottom line, everyone needs to work together, and we need to be spending money on houses, not on home buyers. And that includes both market housing and non-market housing. So there's a lot of partnership that needs to be done around here. And I think it's only going to be through partnership that we're going to solve this affordability and this housing crunch that we're in.
Mike, I want to thank you for taking the time to join us.
Thank you very much.
We've been joined by Michael Capus, who's a partner at KPMG Canada, talking about the budget and talking about the housing issue, right, and the impact on business.
Yeah, when I hear we should all get together and work this thing out, somebody has to quarterback this whole thing.
Yeah,
it's usually on the backs of government. I don't have a lot of faith in any level of government of getting everybody together and solving this problem. Because like Michael said, if we had the solution 5-10 years ago, well, we would have done that.
Right. You don't one get the 10 million units behind overnight.
Correct.
Right? So there's a long-term problem.
Correct. And so for the past 10, 20 years, we haven't got together with all different levels, all stakeholders, yeah, to see how we can have a solution to this. What I find interesting is that the government in each province is competing with each province. Federally, they're trying to get a policy to come in via a budget that will try to make them look like they're trying to help and say, look, well, how much billions of dollars we're supporting the program. But I have yet to see a huge task force to solve the problem. And I'll give you the best example. If this was a natural disaster that happened in Canada, you'd see all levels of government and profit and non-for-profit organizations get together and solve this. Mm-hmm. If we treat this as a natural disaster, we're going to have a solution. We're just not treating it in this manner.
Okay. Run for office. I'll vote for you. You got one vote. I've had an interesting week of conversations this week, Faisal, and you and I were talking about it off air a little bit, about this notion of money managers focusing on, or is money, maybe a better way to say it, is money the number one thing in retirement, make a successful retirement? Is focusing on the money? And I'm not saying that money is not important, but is that the number one thing? Because I can tell you in all of my conversations this past week, none of it had to do with, almost none of it had to do with money. It had to do with the complexity of the retirement situation. It had to do with taxes to be paid, after tax income. It had to do with the complexity of family situations. It had to do with structuring wealth in certain ways to accomplish specific goals. It had nothing, I didn't have one conversation about return this week, which was really interesting. And so if your entire focus in retirement is about portfolio management, are people missing the ball?
Well, I'm gonna flip this on you, Dave. I'm gonna say portfolio management is what part of the problem is for people's retirement.
Do tell.
Okay. So people go to investment advisors, financial advisors, portfolio managers to be the solution to their retirement problem.
Better said. Well said.
And so if the only outcome that you have is the performance of your portfolio, which is table stakes, in my opinion.
Agreed.
You have to have performance.
Right. Yep.
Then you are missing out and potentially damaging your retirement because you're just focused on the money management side.
Right.
How is my portfolio doing? What's the rate of return that I'm getting? Because you told me if I do this rate of return, pick whatever number it says, I'll be okay in my retirement. We have dumbed down the financial planning process in this industry to go after one thing and one thing only, its rate of return.
Not even the financial planning. I think you're correct. We have dumbed down the experience of retirement to whether whatever your return was that year.
I had a great conversation with a long-term client who came to me and said, you know, I was just thinking, Faisal, mm-hmm. if I've got $2 million and I need $100,000 from it, all I need is 5%, right? That's the math that the average Canadian is doing and the average investment advisor, financial planner, financial advisor, portfolio manager saying, yep, that's all you need.
Right.
It is not true. Because the answer to that question, all I need is 5% on my $2 million to get $100,000, is correct in the first year on a pre-tax basis. But what about taxes? What about inflation? What about how you want that money, when you want that money, what currency you want that money in?
Well, yeah, what are you doing with it, right? What are you doing with the money?
Where are you going?
Yeah.
What experience are you going to have with it? What's the intent for that money? Mm-hmm. Like, you're missing out 99% of the problem by just focusing on math that's basic elementary math.
Right.
The amount of money I have times rate of return equals the income that I can get, I won.
And you know how many... And I've had a couple of interesting conversations, so I be careful how I say it. But I would say that these people even understood that whatever last year's rate of return was fine, but they still had no confidence that their long-term retirement lifestyle was intact, was going to be okay, right? So it was an interesting week again. My returns are fine. What's the problem? I don't know if it's sustainable. I don't know if I can do this. I don't know. You know, my family's got a problem. I got to help my kids with the housing. Man, the conversation went from 1 second of, yeah, the return was fine last year, to I still have no idea what's going on here. And it was amazing, right? It was absolutely amazing. And it was a key indication. When I was talking to these people, I said, you realize that we've not talked about portfolio management or rate of return. Oh, yeah. Like they were shocked when we actually finished the conversation. I think we didn't talk about that at all. No, to your point, it's table stakes. You have to be good at that. You have to get, you know, you have to be in that game. But once those table stakes are satisfied, the conversation is nothing about that.
And the real issues of retirement, when you sit down with a couple or an individual, it is all about their life and experiences they want to have.
Yeah.
And what the pain point, remember I talked about this earlier in the show. The pain point that they have is at the pain point they're feeling in the moment, not the pain point they talked about to their advisor 3 years ago when they built a financial plan,
right,
or when the right advisor said, you're going to be okay.
Right.
The pain point back then was, can I retire with the money I have? Now it's, how do I retire? Because I've got a whole bunch of other concerns that maybe I never thought about 3 years ago.
Well, let's talk about change and talk about a big change that we've discussed ad nauseum in our seminars with, there's a difference between singles and couples. I talked to one person who's just gone through a passing of a spouse.
Yeah, a solo retiree.
Right. Guess what? Things have fundamentally changed when you go from a couple, forget about the passing of the spouse, the emotional effect of that. But from a lifestyle planning perspective, as a solo retiree, it's very different than as a couple now. Now, she was smart enough to recognize that. Right? She came in and said, things have changed now.
Yeah.
Right. I realize that. I don't understand all the complexity of it, but I need to go back and figure this thing out.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the key things is you don't always need a prescription.
Right.
You need someone to walk you through the process with.
Right.
And so when you're a solo retiree, or even if you're in a if you're a couple that are retiring, if you don't have a team that's working with you through every single thing you're going to go through in your life, then you are basically only going to focus on the one thing you think you can control, which you really can't, which is the markets, which is your portfolio.
Right.
Unless you're invested in GICs or something that's a guaranteed interest, you can't control much.
Right.
But that's the focus. And it's our industry's viewpoint on that as well. They've used the mechanism of how to retire in a way to present to you a product to buy.
Yeah, exactly. And it frustrates me to no end on this idea of planning for product, right? And again, a couple of the examples this week reinforced that they've done a plan, you said, 3 years ago. Let's just go with that, right? Things have changed. No update to the plan. But like, nobody came back and said, hey, things are fundamentally different now. We need to reduce the plan. No. No change, right? Your portfolio, your rate of return is fine. Wait a second. It's crazy to me, right? That people go from this is it. It's a rate of return that determines the success of my retirement. Not true.
Correct. And let's flip that again. Let's flip it on the other side. Oh, I've been reaching my rate of returns. My retirement is fine.
Right. Thank you.
Again. Let's flip it, right?
That's even said
people,
better.
People will say, oh, my financial plan or my advisor said, all I need is make up a number, 5, 6, 7%. They've delivered that. I'm good.
Right.
Are you?
Right.
Nothing's changed in your vision of what you want in the future. Nothing's changed in taxes.
Right.
In the last 3 years?
Right.
How much tax policy changes have happened in the last 3 years?
Right.
Phenomenal amount. Yeah.
Every budget.
They something. Even bring a policy and then pull it back out the last day.
Exactly.
Like that's.
Well, that's still a bit too soon
still
for that
sensitive
one.
For, right. Sorry, CRA. I had to put that one out there. It's tax season, right? So you're gonna get people who are on both sides of that. Am I okay? And the advisor says I'm okay, and the other side will say, oh, I'm okay because the numbers are right according to that plan that I did 3 years ago. But it's not. Yep. Things have changed.
And retirement is the most complex period of your life financially and otherwise. We're going to talk about that at our upcoming seminars.
So we've got two seminars. One is on April 16, 7 p.m. in Calgary at Silver Springs Golf and Country Club. May 7th in Lethbridge at Sandman Signature Hotel. You need to register for this. So go to morethanmoneyradio.com. That's morethanmoneyradio.com to register.
Okay, and at morethanmoneyradio.com, you can also access all of our past segments that we've done on the More Than Money show. And register for any of our upcoming seminars. Okay, I want to thank you for tuning in to another edition of More Than Money on QR Calgary. On behalf of Faisal, myself, Dave, we look forward to chatting with you next week.
David Popowich and Faisal Carmelli are portfolio managers and investment advisors with CIBC Woodgundy in Calgary. The views of David Popowich and Faisal Carmelli do not necessarily reflect those of CIBC World Markets Inc. Clients are advised to seek advice regarding their particular circumstances from their personal tax and legal advisors. If you are currently a CIBC Woodgundy client, please contact your investment advisor. CIBC Woodgundy is a division of CIBC World Markets Inc., a subsidiary of CIBC and a member of the Canadian Investor Protection Fund and Investment Industry Regulatory Organization of Canada.